and where we are met with cynicism and doubt, and those who tell us that we can't, we will respond with that timeless creed that sums up the spirit of a people. Yes, we can. Yes, 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 it's time. We all come together. Ha-ha! Barack Obama!
Yes, we can, yeah.
Barack Obama! Man, it's coming with a message for the people saying, yes, we can, sure. Si se puede, today is a new day. So come on and throw your hands up, every woman, every man. Barack Obama.
Yes, we can,
Barack Obama.
Feels better than the cute doubt. Political change, critical claim. All in it to rebel is the reign of a power to the people, so that we may develop a sequel. For living enough of the beast, for pushing the envelope, honoring all of the work. Paying attention to reason, dipping our feet and dipping the moderate work. Teaching minds of a new height, seeking prides of a new life. This is the meaning of outreach. When it's out of reach, we still fight.
Barack Obama.
Yes, we can be.
Barack Obama.
Everybody, and welcome to Galactic Roundtable with Beth Trutwin. We will spend the next little while working together on our ascension. We will work on personal, planetary, galactic, universal, omniversal, and cosmic ascension. The cosmos beyond describes all the non-physical antimatter universes. As we creator gods came to this part of the Nebadon universe, aeons ago, we birthed through Mother Sekhmet's Yani at Galactic Center. The end of time has been prophesied in many ethnic cultures for thousands of years. Last summer, August 17th, 2010, the Milky Way galaxy aligned with the sun. This marked the constellation movements of the Mayan calendar. It came sooner than the predicted December 21st, 2012. Time has speeded up due to the collective consciousness of totality and divine grace of all that is, raising their vibrations in a constant process of ascension to a level where we have surpassed the conjunct of the Milky Way with the sun. We are in the end times. It marks the end of the grand experiment of good and evil, of duality. It marks the end of the fallen angels on Earth planet. With their removal, we will become the 33rd member of the Intergalactic Confederation of Worlds. We all have incarnated in physical bodies on Earth to change from a planet of duality to a planet of peace. We are working with the Syrian commander, Barack Obama, who is the 9th member of the Syrian Council of Nine on Sirius A. His head of secret service is a physical template of Lord Sananda, who we call King of Swords. Millions of walk-in souls living in human bodies are all telepathically connected and working together in every walk of life. Police, Interpol, government agencies, military, lawyers, judges, journalists, and too many to list here. Each of us play an important role, where the outcome will be the capture and arrest of the intergalactic war criminals, the fallen angels, who were trying to have Earth and her resources as their own, as well as tens of other planets. We, on the ground crew, work closely with the Galactic Federation, headed by the Admiral, Lord Sananda, a higher aspect of the Prophet Jesus, also known as Yeshua, and the Captain, Lord Ashtar. They have full say in many of the aspects of this mission for Earth ascension. They work directly with President Obama and First Lady Michelle Obama, as well as millions of other white knights around the world. They ask that we call on them, as we need to, for more help in our lives, to help us with our mission. Feel free to call on them, and they will be there at your service. You play an important part in this as you wake up to truth and share the news with others. We must work together to dissolve the programming within the Matrix. I will be pre-recording this program every week. I will be doing it recorded, not live, because it is better for my life situation. It is also less expensive to do a program without the use of an engineer answering the calls and monitoring. I want to thank BBS Radio, the greatest internet radio in the galaxy, for inviting me to be here each week. This is our family and where we join to check in with each other at galacticroundtable.com. I keep this site up to date every day as part of my spiritual service. I have 2 volunteers working with me, and they lovingly devote their service every day. I'm grateful for all who are part of the family at Galactic Roundtable. I manage to keep everything going with your donations, and you may find a donation button on the site. I use the money for electric, Wi-Fi, server fees, and radio broadcasting. I thank you, everybody, for your continuous generosity and love. In exchange, I work hard to give back as much as possible, and you may look at my other website, www.cosmicascension.com. I'm continuously adding to it, and there are many features for self-discovery and healing. This is a place where we go and we raise the questions, where am I? Who am I? Where am I from? And why am I here? I am beginning my charitable mission for World Service post-Nasara. You can find information about Antares Arcturus Midway Foundation at aamidway.com. And as we carry out lives of service to our fellow women, child, and men on Earth inside the Matrix, we continue to have tests and challenges from that concept that I affectionately call 3D. The first dimension is a point in space. The second dimension is a plane, a flat, barren surface. The third dimension is latitude. Imagine a cube with six planes connected together, the top, bottom, and four sides, floating up and down. Within this cube is the third dimensional space. The fourth dimension is time, pure and simple, a point in space in relation to time on a timeline and a dimension. The fifth dimension is the etheric realm with no time. We exist there simultaneously now. We travel in our etheric bodies to the etheric realms at night when we sleep. Our etheric bodies are known by many names, such as our avatar body, like Jake Sully and Neytiri, the lion woman, in the movie Avatar. They are also known as our cosmic consciousness. We are multidimensional beings living on multidimensional Earth as one people, one land, one love. Welcome to Galactic Roundtable on BBSRadio.com, Station 2, where we will discuss all things galactic with divine grace in the totality of all that is. Welcome. Okay, everybody. I noticed lately that I'm hearing more and more that people are suffering in their personal lives. They're clearing and cleansing. I just had an accident last week. You probably heard about that. I'm all better. But everybody are going through these financial challenges and spiritual challenges to the nth degree. And this is the unity consciousness wave pouring over the universe and asking us to discard anything that is not love. And so tonight I want to do a concentration of working on these things together, because we can no longer exist by just surviving. We need to figure out tools to change our consciousness, to help Earth change. And so I want to talk about those things tonight. We are going to study the quantum theory of love tonight. We're going to look at the works of Thomas Merton. He is a Trappist monk who lives in the United States. He was mentioned in Dalai Lama's book about the plurality of faiths. And Thomas Merton was mentioned in his book as a very important person to the Dalai Lama. And unfortunately, he died. Maybe he was killed 3 weeks after he met the Dalai Lama many years ago. I want to do a meditation with you on Christ consciousness. And we will be talking about the divine blueprint tonight, the Mayan calendar and the unity consciousness wave. To begin with, I usually talk about the current events of planet Earth. And there are a lot of stories out there right now. What I want to do tonight is kind of special. You know, I talk a lot about 9/11 truth. And if you go back and revisit entering the war in Afghanistan and the war in Iraq, we all know that if we weren't spending those dollars every day on those wars, that we wouldn't be talking about raising the debt ceiling in the United States. And today the S&P lowered, you know, basically the United States credit limit rating. And it's all a bunch of silliness, because it all, you know, focuses around the fact that if we weren't spending all this money to continue these wars, to suppress and control people throughout the world, that we would all be fine and we'd be able to spend that money taking care of each other. So to me, the exposing the truth about 9/11 is one of the most important things we can do as light workers. I was very lucky, because last week I got to have an exclusive interview with an attorney who filed a lawsuit for a military officer, and her name is April Gallup. She was a victim on 9/11 at the Pentagon, and she sued Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, and Richard Myers. And she wanted to know, if the Pentagon got bombed, where was her protection? If the Pentagon infrastructure was broken by what they called an airplane, where was her protection as their military? They were commissioned with protecting her. Their forces working there in that building, and they didn't do that. So in talking about the current events of Earth, I'd like to rewind that interview for anyone who didn't hear it last week. I want to share it with you again. Thank you very much. Here we go.
Okay. Hi, everybody. I want to welcome you. I'm interviewing this morning the attorney for April Gallup. And this is Bill Veal, and he's going to help answer some questions we have about what happened at the Pentagon on 9/11. Good morning, Bill. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you very much.
Good. I wanted to ask you, I thought I heard April say that her boss called her into work early and told her it's okay to bring your baby because she was returning from maternity leave. And I think what I heard was she was sitting about 40 feet from the hole that penetrated the wall. And I wonder if, you know, she should have been killed in this accident. So I was wondering, why did they call her in early to work that day?
Well, this is one of a thousand questions that we have to people who are learning the Pentagon. It wasn't so much that she was called in early, she was told to go there first before she dropped the kid off to the daycare because they had something that needed to be taken care of before she did anything else. So it's all a mess of questions. There's no guessing about what happened. You're the only way we're ever going to get to the bottom of this is if, you know, we ask the peanut butter and get to ask, you know, her next supervisor and then that person's supervisor, things like that. So, we're a long way from knowing the answers to those questions, I'm sure.
Right, I understand. Well, we all know that on September 10th, 2001, Donald Rumsfeld went on the CBS Nightly News to say that $2.3 trillion was missing from the Pentagon, and they couldn't account for the loss. I was wondering, do you have any information? Did April's work have anything to do with the resource services there, the bookkeepers, accountants, and budget analysts?
I can't answer that question.
Okay, that's cool. I appreciate it. The next question I have is, the 9/11 Commission Counsel, Janice Kephart, revealed in her interview with Jesse Ventura in December of 2010 that the protection of the institution is more important than learning the truth. Based on your experience with Judge Chen and Judge Walker, can you comment on that?
You know, I'm afraid I'm one of these people in the world who thinks that there's nothing more important than the truth. And so I think, you know, the base, the bottom, the support of democracy is, you know, people dealing honestly with each other and understanding what really goes on. And so we're not ever going to have a real democracy in this country where people can make intelligent decisions about their lives until, you know, we know what the constraints are, what the structure is that they're operating under. So I just completely reject the notion. I'd be doctrinaire about it, but that's the fact.
Exactly. I agree with that. So, next I was wondering, you know, we assume Dick Cheney was in the underground bunker at the White House around 9:40. There's different reports. He said as much in his interview with Tim Russert on the 16th of September. Do we know where Rumsfeld and Myers were, and why is that important to April's case?
First of all, with regard to Cheney, I think he was probably in the bunker a lot sooner than 9:40. And one of the most amazing pieces of failures of journalism in this country is the understanding of those first minutes after the second tower was hit. The book that I like to refer to in this instance is Barton Gellman's book, Angler, which talks about the Cheney vice presidency. The interesting thing there is that everybody that was written about this, these people in these times and this administration goes to 9/11 first because that was such a defining moment. And so Gellman has, you know, a number of pages about where Cheney was and what he was doing and things like that, supposedly taken from, you know, records that were made at the time and people that he interviewed, I assume, at the time. And so, you know, if you don't mind me going on about this, about Cheney before we get to Rumsfeld and Myers.
Absolutely. I've heard of other people that were there that hasn't been brought out.
Yeah, well, at any rate, Gellman tells a story that says that Cheney was sitting in his office looking at the television and saying, muttering to himself or to the people around, this is after the first plane hit, gee whiz, how could somebody fly into the World Trade Center to a great big building like that? How could that happen? Then at 9:03, the South Tower is hit, and Gellman then describes the Secret Service reaction and talks about, well, then later on, the Secret Service learns that there's a plane heading toward the White House. And then he names the Secret Service agent. I can't remember what his name is off the top of my head, but then describes the Secret Service agent bringing his hand down on the desk loudly and says, "Now, Mr. Vice President," or whatever, and basically then, from other things, he doesn't describe it this way particularly, but he kind of grabs, you know, Cheney by the back of the belt, and they're up and out of the room.
Mm.
Now, he says that was 9:33 in the morning.
Mm.
I'm a devotee of Webb Ring, and I think there was a lot of verisimilitude in that, but the idea that a Secret Service agent who knows, as everybody else did at 9:03, that the country was under a terrorist attack and waits 30 minutes to get the vice president out of the room, that guy would be fired in a heartbeat. The whole agency would be set up and in place.
It's not a very believable story, is it?
Well, that's simply unbelievable.
Absolutely.
And the fact is, Norman Mineta said that he got down to the bunker about 9:15, 9:20, and Cheney was already there. So, I think, and Cheney has said on other occasions that we got down there shortly thereafter. And he said at one point or another in an interview, I think it was maybe with Rustard, I can't remember, where he said, you don't ask questions, you don't say anything to anybody in moments like that, you do what you're told.
Mm.
And we were up and out of there. I believe that he was in the bunker probably within 5 or 10 minutes, because the point of the matter is, when there is a terrorist attack on the country, unless they actually do know what the shape of the attack is, they don't know what the shape of the attack is. In other words, there may be planes flying here, but there may be somebody with an RPG in Lafayette Park, there may be somebody with a truck bomb, there might be some small airplane that's going to crash into the White House, as it happened back during the Clinton times. Secret Service simply doesn't know how this is going to happen, so they have to protect from every possible eventuality. And, so the first thing you have to do when you don't know what's going to happen is you have to protect the guy in whatever way you can. You don't wait 30 minutes to get him out of the room. So that seems to me, and it was one of the great failures. I remember reading the book and then calling up Art Gellman and said, "Excuse me, did you interview Norman Mineta?"
Mm-hmm.
And he said, "Get to it."
Wow.
And my attempts to contact Barton Young throughout afterwards have been completely a failure. He simply won't talk to me. So, there are lots of problems about trying to get to the heart of this thing, but if we read carefully, we certainly know the questions to ask. With regard to Rumsfeld and Myers, we have the testimony of the book, actually, which is Against All Enemies, written by, by Richard Clark, who was the chief of counterterrorism for Clinton and for Bush at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And he describes how he was conducting a video teleconference between the White House and the Defense Department and the National Military Command Center, and describes how he was sitting there looking at Myers and Rumsfeld as the smoke comes into the room from the attack on the Pentagon. And he, you know, you can infer from that. I can't remember the actual words of the book, but anyway, that's the point is, Rumsfeld said he was in his office until 10 o'clock, didn't know what was going on, and then went down, apparently did go down the lawn to help people out for what reason I can't imagine, but anyway, at some point or other he was down there, but before that, he was in the National Military Command Center because Richard Clark said he was, and I can't think of a reason why Richard Clark would put him there if he wasn't, because I assume that there's a tape of that. I mean, all these things are recorded. So if somebody had to tell us or show to us that we are completely out of line here, or we're making allegations which are unfounded, they could produce a videotape that would show that Myers and Rumsfeld were not there. But I'm pretty sure they were because Richard Clark said they were. So their stories about those things are a matter of lies, which is very important, since Danny Shin didn't seem to think that was very important when he was writing his decision about our case.
Well, just a question, you know, is the National Military Command Center located in the Pentagon?
Yes.
That's something I think people wouldn't realize. And then I'm wondering who else was in on that video conference besides Richard Clark, Myers, and Rumsfeld. Was the vice president on that video, on that conference, was the president, was anyone else there?
The answer to those questions, it's a very important question. I have no idea what the answers to those questions are. My sense, and it's really not more a sense, there's a picture of Cheney in the bunker with Condoleezza Rice and Addington and I can't remember who the other people were, but it doesn't look like the kind of place, of course, cameraman David Borer could have been between himself and the screen, between the screen and the vice president, but it didn't look the kind of high tech kind of place that you would have thought. But that was one picture. I really don't know the answer to the question. I'm just guessing.
Right. I just watched a Mineta video, and he said on the YouTube that Mrs. Cheney was in the PIA with Mr. Cheney.
Yes. That's what I understand.
I've had three NSA agents tell me they were there too.
Uh-huh.
And I don't even know their names. They just gave me a code name. And I'm wondering who else was there. And why were
they there? Well, I'm told that David Borer was there, who's the White House photographer, and Condoleezza Rice, I believe, was there, and I think it was Addington, and then who knows how many other people. And then there was the young man who comes into the room occasionally to brief Mineta, or to brief Jamie that Mineta hears. So I simply don't know the answer to the question. It's a very important question, but I don't know the answer to.
I see. The next question I had was, Norman Mineta testified on tape for the 9/11 commission, and his testimony and tape had a gag order slapped on it, and it was wiped from the record. And he said Vice President Cheney refused, you know, this is just speculation, the way it's being put out there, but if he refused to fire on that, on maybe a cruise missile headed for the Pentagon, did April's complaint touch on this part of it?
Well, what our complaint says is that this is a conspiracy that involved Cheney and Rumsfeld and Myers, and we posit that Flight 77, or maybe even a substitute plane, flew over the Pentagon at the same time that maybe a missile and other bombs or whatever went off inside, and then we cite evidence for that in the discrepancies between the various computer simulations of the flight 77, one going north of the Navy Annex, one going south of the Navy Annex, and how that doesn't make any sense, you know. So, and then there's the altitude of the plane when the black box, the fact that recorder information seemed to end, which would have been, which is true, into the building after the videotape seemed to suggest that he was released by the Pentagon. So, a plane couldn't do that sort of maneuver. It would break up. The wings would fall off if it moved that quickly in that space of time, and it would be simply unable to perform that kind of a maneuver. So those are the things that we rely on to come to the conclusion that probably that airplane flew over the Pentagon. Was it a missile? Was there? I mean, it looks certainly like it. I don't know whether, frankly, that videotape that was released by the Pentagon is real. I mean, I think they're capable of making anything up. But I'm assuming that's real, and that looks like there's some kind of a plane or missile, or whatever, flying into the building, parallel to the ground, right at the ground, basically. That's what it looks like. So I'm assuming that that's what happened, that there was some kind of flying object that went into the plane, into the building at the time that the other plane was flying over. That's just what I guess, but I don't know. I mean, there are all kinds of questions that need to be answered, and we're doing our best to get to the bottom of it, but it's, we're not being helped by the court at this moment.
Right. That's an understatement. All right, so I'm trying to see the picture of when April was there in the Pentagon that morning. So at what I can see, because I watched it on TV, I watched it from the first reporting. So at 8:20 on 9/11, we had the largest attack ever on American soil. And we all know that over the White House and over the Pentagon are no-fly zones. They've been forever. So what was the protocol back then if there were any planes in those no-fly zones? And if this was a cruise missile or even an airplane, what would they have done to stop? What protocol would have been initiated? And if it wasn't initiated, was it not so they could hide the truth?
If you need protocol, you're talking about what kinds of defenses existed and what sort of actions should have been initiated as a result of this threat. Is that what you're talking about?
Right. Well, we assume the story we're told is true, that terrorists attacked the World Trade Center, and we know this. That had happened for an hour, and then we're looking at the Pentagon. So if something's flying through the air through a no-fly zone over the Pentagon, what should we have assumed would have happened?
Oh, well, if you go back even before then, back to the earliest moments, it was 8:15 or something like that when there was any indication at all anywhere in the country that there was a problem. And so, from my understanding, talking to air traffic controllers and things like that, as soon as there is an in-air emergency, an in-flight emergency, that means when you don't know anything, when the transponder goes off, when somebody takes a route that is not prescribed, you determine that there is an emergency there when somebody can't get through to them. The first thing that you do is you go to the Air Force and you say, hey, listen, we got a problem here. Get somebody up there. That's the first thing you do. Now, if had, for example, the pilots squawked in the hijack code, which takes a matter of several seconds, but that's about all it takes, which should have happened. It hasn't happened yet on any of those flights. There was never a hijack code squawked. So you wonder whether or not there was actually what was going on. But anyway, it had been made clear to the air traffic controllers that there was a hijack going on, then there is not this immediate sense of emergency. You don't necessarily send the jets up in order to intercept right away when there's a hijack. You might get them into the air and then have them trail behind. But when you've got an in-flight emergency like we have here, you don't know that it's a hijack. You just got an in-flight flight emergency. What you do is you get the airplanes up in the air right away. So it's usually within 10 minutes, you've got airplanes right there next to the plane trying to figure out what's going on. And so then, if at some point or another they actually have the ability to shoot the plane down, and, that used to be clearer than it is than it was in June of 2001. But it's certainly even then, if they had followed protocol properly, they would have had jets in the air. before those planes ever got close to New York. And when they saw them flying towards the World Trade Center, they would have called their boss and say, what should I do? And the boss would say, shoot it down, because this is something we can't, you know, this is getting bad. We're getting, you know, we don't know what's going on here, and they're flying right towards the World Trade Center, so we've got to shoot them down. And that probably would have gone to the Secretary of Defense or to the President.
Not to interrupt you, but can I interject something here?
Sure.
I grew up on Long Island, and my mom worked for Lufthansa for 10 years, and she was a cargo agent. And growing up on Long Island, I mean, we knew it was common knowledge that over Manhattan's a no-fly zone. So when there wouldn't even be a disabled aircraft that close to lower Manhattan. That would shoot off the alarms for even civilians who know nothing.
Yeah, right. That's right. Certainly, I mean, there's if you talk about the Pentagon, there's a problem with the Pentagon in the fact that the Reagan National Airport is right next to the Pentagon.
Right.
So there are planes flying in that neighborhood all the time. And, but there are lanes that they are able to fly in, and they have these codes that says, I'm flying to Reagan or whatever. So if you have somebody in the airspace there, which, is not responding, then something has to have happened to disable our defenses. And that's what I believe did happen in this incident. They were told to stand down.
Mm-hmm. Right. I went to high school with a friend who was an air traffic controller working at JFK when this happened. And to this day, he still won't share his story, but all I was told was a few days after this happened, he was offered a job at Homeland Security.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what else they said to him. He won't talk. My next question is, regarding April's case, what are the obligations of the Secretary of Defense and the Joint Chief of Staff in the event of attack on the military on American soil by a foreign invasion?
They've got a duty to protect the United States and its citizens. So, put simply, that's the fact. So, they have their forces and they deploy them to repel the attack. That's their job. If you're looking for something more than that, that's the fact.
Right. Well, that's a point about the case that's not talked about a lot.
I'm not sure I understand. You're saying that, explain to me what you mean more, because I'm not sure I understand.
I blog, and I talk to people on the radio, and people ask me questions. I get thousands of emails every week, and I feel the pulse of what people remember about 9/11 and what questions still linger, because we were all given this psychological attack that day. And so there's glitches in the memory, and the Pentagon was the least talked about of all of them. And I think the fact that our leadership and our military completely ignored this incoming, whatever it was, apparently a plane, on our military is just confounding.
No. You're right. And let me just say that if you can just take yourself out of that moment of horror when we learned about these things, and just say, these however many words they are, the Pentagon was successfully attacked. So here it is. It's the headquarters of the mightiest military force that's ever been conceived by man or created by man. There it is. And somebody hit it. Somebody attacked successfully. Now, wait a minute. That just has to stop you in your tracks. You say, wait a minute. How could that possibly happen? There is, such enormous quantities of resources, of intelligence, of machinery, of human resource. There is the wealth of the American right there. Why would you not be able to protect that building? And the answer is, of course you protect that building. And there are all kinds of stories about there actually are, there are batteries of anti-aircraft batteries around it in some way or another. But a friend of mine who, worked as an Army or Air Force officer, said that at the very least they have these handheld, they have people stationed who have handheld missiles that can take out anything. There are protections clearly there. So when you're presented with the notion that the headquarters was attacked, you've got to stop yourself in your tracks and say, wait a minute, we've got some questions to ask here.
Right.
And that's where this investigation has gone. That's why April Gallup is in the position that she is in now today. She said, wait a minute, where are our protections? And she tried to get those questions asked of the 9/11 commission, and Rumsfeld just danced around and wouldn't answer anything, and to the extent that the commissioners would ask them, which was not particularly impressive either. So the ideas, there are a couple of, well, there are 50 ideas, but, take two or three. The Pentagon was attacked successfully, and let's just take that idea. That's a very powerful one, if that can't be. But the other one that just, lights me up is April Gallup walked out of the Pentagon. Well, when did she walk out? She walked out where the plane flew in, according to what plane? Well, it was a 757, a Boeing 757. It's an enormous aircraft. How did it get in there? Well, it was flying 530 miles an hour. I see. It was flying 530 miles an hour when it hit the building, and it went into the building. I see. And she was 40 feet away from the edge of the hole that plane flew into. Now, where's that plane now? Well, it was vaporized by all the heat that was created. Oh, I see. So there's nothing left of the plane. Well, basically, there's nothing left of the plane because of all the heat. I see. All right. And April Gallup walked out of that hole within minutes. She was not. She picked up her child. She walked out. She ended up on the lawn without, being burnt. Yeah, anything like that.
Can I interject something just for real
sure.
quick? I worked for Workers' Compensation Reinsurance Association in the state of Minnesota, and I'm a registered nurse, and I reviewed medical cases. We had a lady, a single-engine aircraft, flew into the building where she was typing on her computer and exploded near her desk, and we were treating her for burns on 80% of her body, and that was a single-engine aircraft. So it's insane to assume that that's even possible, what you're saying, that April...
I think that you've used a good word. It's insane. It's insane. But apparently, who knows what the Second Circuit's going to do, but they weren't particularly interested in that particular point, I'll have to say.
Well, when the airplane flew into the World Trade Center, it was so hot and there was so much fuel, it exploded it and made it fall to the ground. But when it flew into the Pentagon, April could walk through the hole a few minutes later.
That's right. Well, I'm afraid I've pretty much run out of time here. If you don't mind, I apologize, but I'm literally in the middle of some other things. So if I can thank you very much for interviewing me, I appreciate it, but I'll have to say goodbye.
It's been so nice to get to talk to you. I appreciate your time so very much.
Take care of yourself. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot. Bye.
Yeah, bye-bye.
Meg Hiller joined the 150 or so protesters on a corner of the SMU campus set aside for the event. It was well away from the groundbreaking and surrounded by barricades and police. Hiller expects she'll be back on campus for protests once the library opens.
I do want to hold the library and the think tank responsible for getting the truth out instead of rewriting history.
Cindy Sheehan protested for months outside Bush's Crawford Ranch and now says anti-war protesters are stepping it up after taking a backseat to the economy for the past couple of years.
You know, the things are still continuing under Obama, and Obama's administration is protecting the Bush administration. And so we need more and more gatherings of George Bush is going to be met all over the country and everywhere he goes with people like us saying, no, he needs to be arrested and tried for war crimes.
The protesters say the war in Iraq is illegal, started on fabricated claims of weapons of mass destruction, and they call Bush's sanction of waterboarding illegal under international law. Those allegations were countered by a small group of Bush backers, including Tommy Bobo and SMU junior Scott McCall.
I'm out here to support Bush, and I'm glad the Bush Library is in Dallas.
I'm disgusted by the protests because they represent something that this campus doesn't stand for. The SMU students are grateful for President Bush and the library to come here.
So first of all, then we
A couple of campus police officers stepped between the two groups at one point to manage the verbal sparring, but there were no arrests. Businessman Cliff Clark appreciates both sides. He came downstairs from his nearby office to watch the protest and take a few pictures to post on Facebook.
Well, I love the library. The concept is fantastic. And protest is, you know, it's everybody's freedom to protest. It's freedom. It's America. It's what makes us a great country, so we can protest and celebrate at the same time.
BJ Austin, KERA News. Meg Hillert joined the 150 or so protesters on a corner of the SMU campus set aside for the event. It was well away from the groundbreaking and surrounded by...
Okay, everybody. Thank you for listening. Now I think it's time for a song. Here we go.
Now I've been happy lately, thinking about good things to come, and I believe it could be something good has begun. Oh, I've been smiling lately, dreaming about the world at one, and I believe it could be someday it's going to come. Cause out on the edge of darkness, there rides a peace train. Oh, peace train, take this country, come take me home again. Now I've been smiling lately, thinking about the good things to come, and I believe it could be something good has begun. Peace train sounding out of the
side of the peace train.
Come on, the peace train. Is peace train a holy roller?
Let's do another one, the peace train.
Come on, the peace train. Get your bags together. Come. Bring your good friends too, cause it's getting nearer, it soon will be with you. Come and join the living, let's have some fun from you. And it's getting nearer, soon it will all be true. Oh, peace train sounding louder,
out of the peace train.
Everyone jump up on the peace train. Ooh, 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 ooh.
All right, everybody. So, ever since March 9th, when the new Unity Consciousness wave started pouring over the earth, it really gave us a shake up on so many levels. We've been watching the toppling of governments and the devastation in Japan and how Mother Earth is changing to accommodate the new Unity Consciousness wave. And so we are being invited by the universe to change our thinking, to change our outmoded, not operating well, old ways of coping with life on Earth. It's important that we open the new key codes of consciousness and garner new strategies, new thought waves, new ways of dealing with problems that we didn't use before and are no longer working. On that note, I would like to share a book with you. This is called The Quantum Theory of Love, written by Beryl Payne. And if you want more information, you can go to www.beryl.com. What is the quantum theory of love? It's a simple finding that mathematically demonstrates how you can change the world. The main idea is based on the quantum theory as originally formulated and the mathematics of compound interest. To develop a theory, one has to start with a clear definition. In physics, the quantum theory was postulated to account for some unexplained behavior of light waves. It appeared that light waves change frequency in very small, discrete amounts. These very small changes were called quanta, taking less than a microsecond to change from one frequency to another. Quanta have become the new smallest particle and have replaced the atom as the new building block. Frequency shifts come in discrete changes, so does energy, as shown through experiments. This tiny bit of energy can be described as quantum. After a while, these two notions fuse together to form the basis of the quantum theory. Quanta are submicroscopic chunks of unknown energy. For additional information about spin, another fundamental parameter of quantum theory, please see page 42. In economics, a quantum of money might be one penny. In computer language, a quantum might be a zero or a one, one bit of information. One penny is just one quantum, but many quanta add up to a mountain of pennies. The existence of atoms led to the formation of an atomic theory of matter. About 100 years ago, it was discovered that atoms could be broken down into several smaller particles, and these in turn were found to be ultimately be composed of whirling bundles of energy that radiate in tiny energy chunks called quanta. Now physicists have formulated a quantum theory of matter based upon their experimental findings. A love quantum. Since the notion of a quantum is a tiny bit of something, quantum mechanics can be applied to a non-physical thing, such as love. For a quantum theory of love to be developed, then, we must ask, what is the tiniest bit of love that one can give? A smile, or even half a smile, a friendly nod, or just a thought? What's your definition of a quantum of love? Whatever the quantum of love turns out to be, we don't have to wait to develop a useful theory. Defining a quantum theory of love is a tough job, even for Einstein. The implications of the quantum theory of love. For the most part, well-balanced human beings act like love amplifiers. In electronics, amplifiers convert an input current to an output current. With a given input current, the gain or volume determines how large the output current will be. In interactions with each other, most human beings seem to operate with a gain of about one. That is, they do as asked, sometimes a little more, sometimes a little less. It's been my experience that most people in the countries I've visited are basically friendly and helpful. The ordinary person does not operate with a significant negative or positive gain factor, but extremes do exist. When we look around, we see that some people are operating with a love gain factor just slightly less than one. That is, they often are a bit unfriendly, but return a smile. Don't return a smile and leave a place a little bit dirtier than when they came, or are apt to take advantage of a situation in a selfish way. They usually do not do this deliberately, just unconsciously. This is most noticeable in the effects of the environment. People will come to a place, say a public beach, and leave, picking up most of their garbage except perhaps one cigarette butt or a gum wrapper. The next person to visit may leave a tiny bit of plastic and so on. After a time, that place will be a mess. This is happening all around the world, in the oceans, the air, and now even in outer space. The whole planet is slowly becoming trashed. Numerical analysis of the quantum theory. Multiplying 1 times 1 times 1 times 1, you will always get 1, no matter how many times the multiplication is carried out. Multiplying 0.9 times 0.9 times 0.9 times 0.9, you will get 0.66 after only 4 times, and the result will approach 0, rapidly with continued interactions. Fortunately, most people operate much closer to a gain of 1. But if there are 100 people operating at a gain of 0.99, the outcome will be close to 0. Even if there are millions of people operating at a gain of 0.9999999, the eventual outcome of millions of interactions still approaches 0. The key theorem of the quantum theory of love is a comparison of 2 mathematical formulas, 1 minus q to the nth power and 1 plus q to the nth power. The Q stands for the single quantum of love, and N is simply the number of times a positive or a negative interaction occurs between people. It does not matter what Q is or how it is defined. When a normal interaction is slightly positive by the addition of 1 quanta, the sum continues to grow larger and larger. On the other hand, if the normal interaction is even significantly negative, the sum will eventually decrease to 0. Now, suppose that the energy of love is being amplified, no matter how we measure or define love. If each human being acts like a love amplifier, with a variable gain, usually set to around 1, then we can predict the result. If each person sets their love amplifier exactly to a gain of 1, then the net result of many human interactions will be 1, or unity. If each person, on the average, sets the gain of their love amplifier to 1 minus, just one teeny-weeny quantum of love, then the world will eventually end up with the total love energy approaching 0. This will happen in spite of the heroic work of many powerful and loving individuals. Human interactions are very complex. Even so, suppose human interactions work like compound interest, where every time a certain percent of the total is added to the whole amount, then we could assume that each interaction during the day is a chance to give back a quantum more love than we get. Perhaps saying a gracious thank you rather than a grumpy thank you, or no thank you at all, can make a difference. Or even a smile during an interaction instead of no smile at all. And perhaps a smile if the other person appears sad, depressed, or not present at all. Love can be contagious. Or maybe it means picking up just one piece of litter, even if the place is full of trash. If you just pick up one piece of litter, just try one tiny piece. Someone else might also pick up one itsy-bitsy piece, and on until there is no more trash. Your efforts could be compounded or amplified like compound interest for every interaction. The graph for compound interest curves upward. This is represented on this illustration. Suppose you choose to respond slightly less graciously even grumpily, no matter how small of an amount of negativity you release, say 0.000001 less love than one, then the curve on the line will slant downwards, and no matter what mathematical model is assumed, the result will eventually be zero. There's a picture of a crying zero in the book. It's a choice, the positive solution. By conscious effort, it is possible to increase the gain of one's amplifier. If each person makes the minimal conscious effort to increase the gain by a small amount, just enough to make it greater than one, then the result will be a continuously increasing amount of love energy. 1.01 times 1.01 times 1.01 times 1.01 becomes greater than 2 after only 100 interactions. It doesn't matter how small a quantum of love is. As long as each individual increases their gain by any amount, the total amount of love in the world will steadily increase. A lot of people need to make a conscious effort to increase their love energy gain in order to make a difference. They don't need to make a big change, just a small one. Perhaps only a change of one quantum will be sufficient to get from slightly negative to slightly positive. But this could be enough to eventually change the whole world. This small change in the consciousness could be taught to each generation of children. If it seems hard to be even one quantum more loving to someone else or to yourself, practice love on living things. After practicing with animals or plants, you might graduate to loving your body, perhaps, or just one toe at a time. Also recognize that besides giving, receiving is important too. People need to give just as much as people need to receive. For a complete circuit, both are necessary. So practice receiving. At present, the world's problems seem enormous and beyond our individual ability to influence them. The responsibility of changing anything on a world scale is just too much for one person. But if you are willing to add just one quantum of love to your interactions, then you can help switch the mass human output from negative to positive. It's fun. It's easy. Even if other people are only operating with a gain of one, if you are loving or considerate to them by just one quantum, they may add that extra bit and pass it on to others. Since most people interact with dozens to hundreds of others, whatever small change one person makes will eventually impact the whole network of humanity. If perhaps only 10% of the people made a personal commitment to add an extra quantum of love to their life, the world would start improving rather than declining. It is time now to expand the golden rule of doing unto others as you would have them do unto you, to the golden rule plus one, where the one stands for one quantum more than usual, whether it is one quantum more of money, good wishes, or assistance, the golden rule plus one. Feeling depressed? Practice improving your mood by thinking of one tiny positive thought, a positive quantum. Share the positive thought with others. Will respond positively, giving you an additional quantum of good thought. After a short time, you will find your mood improving. All you need is to make a change of one quantum and have a bit of practice. A similar effect can happen when someone else is upset or angry. No need to try to change them. Change your response one positive quantum. They will probably change on their own accord. As the world is now, it is no longer sufficient that each person be neutral or do exactly their own thing without bothering anyone else. We need to assume personal responsibility for the whole world. It is necessary that each person do a little bit more to care for the world. How much more? Why, just one quanta. It's easy in theory. Give it a try. The golden rule plus one. The end. I love that little book. I hope you enjoyed it. The next thing I'd like to do is talk a little bit about Christ consciousness and then do a meditation. But I think first, we're going to have a song, okay? Here we go, everybody. Oldie, but a goodie. This is from 1971. Now, I want to share something with you about Christ Consciousness Love, and then we're going to do a meditation. This comes from the book called From Self-Love to Christ Consciousness by Paul McCartney. And it says, what does it feel like? Christ Consciousness Love is experienced fundamentally within your heart. It is a state of being that is achieved by primarily thinking Christ consciousness thoughts. When I am being the energies of Christ consciousness, the most obvious and predominant thing I experience is profound love. I feel my heart chakra expand greatly and energy levels rise noticeably. When people connect and work with the ascended masters, angels, Star Masters of Light, They experience most notice is profound love that envelops them as these guides have their being rooted within Christ consciousness. What does it feel like? For me, it is the love that goes beyond existing definitions. It is an act of being love and merging into love on a larger scale without boundaries. If you have not experienced it, then maybe it's hard to imagine. If you do not know what to expect, how do you know when to have it, when you have it, or what you are looking for? If I explain how I experience it, then this may act as a guide. We all experience things differently, and so you should be open to different experiences than what I've described. I experience it these ways. At first, my heart felt tender and sensitive, but not in a painful way. Then it becomes an exquisite feeling of bliss, joy, and ecstasy that makes me feel complete and whole. I feel sensuous, calm, and peaceful. My senses feel heightened, fresh, and alert. There is certainty and clarity of being and feeling. There is a sense of belonging everywhere. The air feels alive around me as if the boundaries between me and the rest of the world are less certain. There is a feeling that I am merged into oneness and that my focus here in my body is by choice and that I can merge further if I want to. I feel deeply loving to everything and everyone. This love wants to express itself. The urge to give and share is compelling. Strangely enough, my first experience of Christ consciousness was when I was shopping in a supermarket. Out of nowhere, a powerful feeling of love and belonging enveloped me. I remember looking at all the faces of the other shoppers and feeling profound love for all of them without exception. I felt a common bond with everyone individually. I think it goes to show that our breakthroughs and new experiences can happen at any time. The timings of such things are outside the control of our personality, but nevertheless are beautiful and perfect as they express the wisdom of the total universe itself. If we go down the path of spiritual development, then we open ourselves to new worlds and go beyond even our imagination in terms of profundity and complexity. How to achieve Christ consciousness? Christ consciousness is a thought, a feeling, a doing, a saying, a being, and it is expression. It is all the things that you can imagine in a life. So seek the perfection of the Christ consciousness being, an expression in everything you are and do. Enjoy the profundity of the experience of the Christ consciousness. Know that it is here and has never gone away. It is yours by birthright. Know that I am here together with the spiritual hierarchy to help you reclaim that which has always been yours. I send you my Christ consciousness blessings, Lord Maitreya. I like to use the phrase Christ consciousness instead of universal love, as it is useful in reminding us that it is primarily our thoughts and feelings that govern the type of love that we experience. Our thoughts create our reality, so when our thoughts are centered around unconditional love, peace, non-judgment, compassion and serving others, we experience Christ consciousness and become a physical expression of it. The opposite is true, which means that negative thoughts such as fear, selfishness, anger, and a lack of forgiveness result in us expressing ourselves through the negative ego. Living life under the expression of the negative ego leads to a miserable and joyless existence. We can take responsibility for our thoughts and choose to live and enjoy life by being the Christ consciousness. How do we do this? It is mainly through the art of self-inquiry, which means we constantly observe our thoughts. Where we find negative ego thoughts, we replace them with Christ consciousness thoughts. Your thoughts directly affect your emotions, and so as you make your thoughts more positive, so too do your emotions become more positive. The best living teacher of the process of transforming your consciousness this way is Dr. Joshua Stone of the I Am University, www.iamuniversity.org, who is a leader and expert in this area. His book, Soul Psychology, is dedicated to the subject and is an essential tool for all of us to use. Dr. Stone also reminds us that Christ consciousness is not especially linked to Christianity or any religion by calling it Christ Buddha consciousness, which invites everyone to identify with it regardless of faith, race, or background. Our thoughts are things and are energetic. When we think negative thoughts, we feel the effect of the denser energy they express. This is equivalent to mental poison. Here is an exercise demonstrating this. If you have a problem that results in causing you emotional and mental suffering, then use this as your own example of mental poison. Look at your situation in detail and identify your negative thoughts that are related to it. Then replace these with positive thoughts and keep this up constantly for a period of 3 days. You should be able to notice a change in your feelings and physical energy levels. You may feel lighter, happier, and more positive. Negative thoughts and emotions drain us of energy, causing suffering. In order to complete this process, you need to do this a period of at least 21 days. This is the period that is required to reprogram the subconscious mind, which is the part of us held onto these negative beliefs. You can use positive affirmations and visualizations to accelerate the process. Now, everybody, I want to share a meditation with you, focusing on Christ consciousness. Just let me look at it here. Okay. Experiencing Christ Consciousness Energetic Meditation. The Syrian Masters of Light work in deep ways to bring through the experience of joy of Christ Consciousness to those who are ready for it and welcome this gift. They are very evolved and powerful Masters of Christ Consciousness. They have offered to channel Christ Consciousness energies to those who wish to ask for this experience. In reality, it is more than just an experience, as it is a type of fast-track preparation for our four-body system to allow for the reception and integration of these high frequencies of energies, both now and in the future. The meditation is in no way meant to replace any inner work, such as self-inquiry, visualizations, or affirmations. It is complementary and accelerates your progress as you progress with your inner work. The meditation is only required once in this lifetime. However, you are required to honor this gift by committing to the following process. Sit in meditation 45 minutes on 3 separate occasions with a gap of 1 or 2 weeks in between each session. The format for each meditation is the same as those in previous chapters. All you have to do is ask for the relevant meditation, and the energies will be channeled directly to you. You will probably feel the energies in your aura, as well as experiencing them on all levels. Please remember, you have a link through this book to any relevant masters that have volunteered to help you with these meditations. Meditation number 1, laying the foundations. I would ask you to open your heart and mind to expand your aura. This will allow the preparations to take place so that you can receive those higher energies that constitute the experience of the Christ consciousness to the level that is possible for you at this moment. The first meditation prepares the four-body system by cleansing the aura, raising the vibration of all the component parts, and to prepare the body to hold and recognize these frequencies at the cellular level. Meditation number 2, attunement. The second meditation is an attunement to the Christ consciousness energies, where you will be bathed in them and have the experiences of being the expanded Christ consciousness. This meditation will allow you to more easily repeat this attunement or tune into the Christ energies, the Christ consciousness energies that exist on a planetary level and beyond. Meditation number 3, anchoring. The third meditation is an anchoring of the Christ consciousness energies. These energies will become a more permanent part of your being. You will carry these energies within your energetic makeup. You will have to think, act, and be the Christ consciousness. However, these meditations make it easier and allow you to be more aware and sensitive to the experience on an energetic level. All right, everybody, let's join in a meditation together now. I would like to join with you to do a planetary Earth meditation. Relax and close your eyes. Take 3 deep breaths. On the in-breath, breathe in peace. And on the out-breath, breathe out all negative emotions and beliefs that do not support this meditation. Ask out loud that you are protected by Archangel Michael throughout the meditation. Request that he place his golden dome of protection around you. Visualize your favorite scene in nature. It can be anywhere you like. Maybe it is a seaside or a forest scene. Make it as beautiful as you can. Feel the love, appreciation, and gratitude that you have for nature and its mother, the planet Earth. Now, take these feelings and imagine wrapping them in a present in the most beautiful way. Now send your present down into the center and into the heart of the earth. Wait a moment as you expect a response. Feel energy envelop you. It is the love that Mother Earth has for you. Bathe in it and let it move within you to the greatest degree that it can. Feel grounded and supported by the energy. When you've had enough, thank Mother Earth and bring your awareness back to the room. You can connect to the energy of the earth in this way whenever you want. You can make the process as long or as short as you want. It can be done within seconds if you're busy. It just requires you to intend it so. Be open to the fact that when you rekindle this relationship, there will be a response, and Mother Earth, through her energy, consciousness, and nature, will make her presence known to you. You will receive blessings and guidance from the world around you. This type of connection is truly a wonderful thing, as it allows you to understand the depth to which you are nourished and taken care of by Mother Earth. The reconnection to planet Earth is quite a profound experience, and for many people it will be moving. Be open to receive the love of Mother Earth. Have the eyes to see how she communicated to you through her messengers, such as birds and animals. Regularly show your appreciation and gratitude for Mother Earth for the food you eat, the clothes you wear, the air that you breathe, and the water you drink. Please understand that the animals and plant kingdoms are part of this too, as well as the magical kingdoms, and they are not separate from you in this experience. That was very sweet, and as we study these new tools of changing our consciousness, then we grow and we expand and we're able to bring those vibrations and help raise Mother Earth and really, really make a difference in the change. So everybody, in a minute, we're going to go shift gears and talk about the divine blueprint. But before that, I'd like to have a song, please. Here we go. This is another oldie. I was looking at the oldies today, everybody. Okay, everybody, thank you. Now I'd like to share with you what April Gallup had to say about what happened to her in the Pentagon on 9/11. This was released in 2008. Here you go.
On September 11, 2001, I had returned back from maternity leave. I had to get Elijah situated in daycare. I walked into the building. Had to clear Elijah to go to the area. There were some things that they wanted me to take care of prior to me taking him to the daycare. I sat down at the computer to actually turn the computer on. As soon as I pressed the button, boom. So at that particular time, based off what happened, I thought I had triggered a bomb. I was covered from my neck all the way down to my back in debris. My son was completely blown out of his stroller, and some of the floors had collapsed within, and people were trapped in between the floors. My son had stopped crying, so I felt strength out of nowhere to actually low crawl from out under the debris to try to find my son. But because there were so many people in that area, whether they were screaming or, you know, crying or saying, help me, save me, I felt pretty much divided. I didn't know if to help them first or to try to find my son. But I had tried to lift some of the debris to find my son, and I wasn't able to locate him, so I helped the other people with the thought that they would help me find my son. But due to all the hysteria, they just wanted to get out. There was an area where there was a pack of debris. We climbed over it, and in one last effort, I had reached down while there were two people holding my arm. I had reached down under a pack of debris and pulled my son up by his onesie, which is a t-shirt that snapped in between a child's leg. I put him over my shoulder and proceeded to get out of that particular location that had collapsed. And I came out in what is believed to be the entrance or the place of initial impact and was placed on the lawn that was closest to the highway prior to be transported to the hospital on that particular day. While I was coming out of the Pentagon, I didn't see any evidence of metal, airplane seats, you know, luggage, nothing that would give me any indication that it was a plane that had hit the building. I lost one shoe, so I was walking through the area barefooted. So I was particularly careful to try to make sure I did not step on anything sharp while I had my son on my shoulder. I did not have jet fuel over my body. My son didn't have jet fuel over his body. The people that I helped didn't have jet fuel on their body. So again, there was nothing on the inside that would give me any indication that there was a plane on that particular day that hit the building. Most of the people that were in the area where I was located, and again, I did ask because maybe I was off in my judgment, but in speaking with everyone, it was conclusive that no one else in the area where I was located had seen any parts of planes or luggage or baggage or anything of that nature. Yes, I believe it's something part of much more sinister, and that's why my goal is to try to push for a federal grand jury so that people can be brought forth for perjury and obstruction of justice. I mean, when you go out of your way to fabricate an official story, when obviously the evidence that appears, whether it's footage or the work that many people have done, shows that the official story couldn't possibly be true, then yes, you should be brought to justice. And when people can come together and feel like they can utilize, you know, human beings as lambs to a slaughter, yes, that's what's unpatriotic. That's what's un-American. I mean, we'll turn our own people to sacrifice them for whatever their motive may be, regardless that their motive is of no significance, but the fact that they would use, innocent human beings as lambs to a slaughter to perpetrate whatever it is their cause or motive is. Yes, they should be brought to justice, and it's obvious, you know, that the official story is... it has been fabricated, pretty much.
Yes, it's been fabricated. It's very important that we share this story far and wide and get the truth of 9/11 out there, everybody. Thank you. Thank you.